talking the other day, and it turns out that when we apply the patches in the handler, if we just let it go through the normal path, then we don't have to handle any extra cases because the page stays in the swap cache. So anything that gets so when shrink page list gets called to evict pages, if for some reason the process that was using that page is no longer active, then the page simply just gets evicted again.
Hmm.
So anything normal that happens, it just goes through the regular path, and we don't really have to change anything there.
We don't need to do any additional cleanup or.
It's just setting some flags.
Upload the patches, unlock the page, and that's it, right?
Yeah.
And you did that.
Yeah.
And it works fine.
I was trying to test it yesterday, but for some reason VMware Fusion wasn't playing well with me.
Okay.
Hmm.
But it was a problem on your code, or it was something?
No, it was the actual software.
Okay.
My laptop wasn't liking it.
Okay.
Hmm. You're running on Mac.
Yeah.
Fusion on Mac. Okay. So. Yeah, I'm a little slow, so let me try to understand better. So you're saying that earlier you were applying the patches in a separate thread, right, a kernel
mm-hmm.
thread, that would pick out pages from a queue, and then when I was complete, right, and there was some issue because there might be, you know, some blocking, unnecessary blocking, because the queue is first in, first out, right?
Mm-hmm.
And doing it that way, we had to do some additional cleaning or clean up after a process completes or something like that?
We had to check if a process was still there, and if it wasn't, then we had to do some extra stuff. So.
I guess reallocate the page or something like
the
that.
The idea
right?
was that, I mean, the reason why that thread was there is because we wanted to set up the page table of the processes that faulted on that page right away
mm-hmm.
in the completion of the audit,
mm-hmm.
right? So what we said last time is that we don't need to do that.
Mm.
But instead, when the process faults on that page again, there will be a minor fault,
and
the
page table
will be updated and everything for us, right?
Okay, I see. And what about the memory for the page itself? When does that get cleaned up if the process no longer exists?
It'll probably get cleaned up on the next call to shrink page list.
Okay.
It'll just go through the swap cache, see that the page is no longer mapped,
mm-hmm.
because when the process exits, it lowers the map count.
Okay.
So if the map count is zero, it just evicts the page that it needs to.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's good. So does this mean that our code becomes cleaner?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think it solves some race conditions we were having before.
Okay.
But it also, we were looking at it, and it breaks copy on write pages.
No, I know.
Hmm.
So, because the thing is, when the IO completion finishes, we check to see, we just apply the patches.
Hmm.
But we don't really check if the page is copy on write or anything. I was looking into that, and I'm not sure. I didn't see a flag. At least it wasn't obvious. But
I guess
there is one.
There has to be one, right? I mean, the OS needs to mark the page somehow to be copy on write.
No, but it doesn't have to be the page. It has to be the entry.
In the VMA.
In the VMA.
Which is why.
Right? I mean, in the VMA, you say, I'm pointing to this page,
mm-hmm.
but
and
by the way,
it's
a copy and write. So if there is a write to that page, we need to create a new copy.
Yeah, because it could be a page that was forked. So for one process,
mm-hmm.
it can write to it, but for others, it's copy and write.
Okay.
Oh, no, you're right. It's both
copy and write.
And the first one that faults gets in your mind.
Exactly.
In what case would it be that...
So you're saying that because we don't detect that a certain page is a copy on write page, we write directly to the page without actually creating a copy first?
I guess
or apply the patches without creating a copy?
I think the problem is like this. So there is a write to a page,
mm-hmm.
that is copy and write, but the page is not in memory.
Yes.
Right? So what would normally happen is that you read the page first, create
mm-hmm.
a copy,
mm-hmm.
and you have two, and you write to the right one.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we're doing is that we don't see if it's a copy or write or
mm-hmm.
not, but
mm-hmm.
we create a patch
mm-hmm.
for a page, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we return.
So I guess the question is, do we handle this at the time of creating a patch or at the time of applying the patch? I mean, the creating a copy.
Your question is,
when should we create a copy of the page?
When should we handle this?
When should we somehow handle the fact that there are two pages and not one, right?
The problem though is that to do it has to create a copy. It has to create the page copy, and that can sleep, so it can't really be done in the interrupt handler, which is the problem. And checking to see if.
What if we do it at the time of the fault?
Well, the thing is, the page has to be in memory to be made a copy of.
To make a copy.
No, but I'm saying that we could do exactly the same thing as, create that extra mapping, right, to an on-disk page. So both pages are on-disk, right, and the copy is for the on-disk version.
No, but there is a single copy, right? Yeah, because they're copying one page.
Sorry, Ricardo, can you repeat?
But if you have a write, you have to create a copy, right?
Yeah. So I guess the first question is, when do we handle this creation of the copy? Excuse me.
So what normally happens on the vanilla path?
So on the vanilla path, it runs through and it blocks on the page. When it gets read in, it does some extra checking, and then before it sets up the page tables, it calls a do WP page, and that does the copy on write pages.
So that, and this is after the process gets unblocked. All of this is handling is after the process gets unblocked.
No, this is before.
Oh, this is inside the handler?
Yeah, this is inside the handler, because the handler itself blocks for the I/O. So when it gets read in is when it does the checking, and then it calls a do WP page.
But if that
goes through.
But I thought you said that can block, and you cannot block inside the handler, right?
You can block inside the handler because it's in process context.
Oh, then that means that the process got unblocked.
Well, the process is running just in
kernel mode.
So can we do something like, I mean, this. Can we do something, because there are two pages involved, right?
Mm-hmm.
The page that is to be modified and the original page.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is that it creates a new page,
mm-hmm.
right? And then we copy the content of the original page to this page.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if we create a patch of the whole content for this page?
But we don't have the whole content.
Yeah, we would have to wait.
Oh, we don't have the whole content.
I was thinking that we could create, if you're making a copy and write operation, instead of creating a copy and write page itself, we could create a mapping, that a copy of the mapping, and both entries would point to the same location on disk.
Okay.
Or actually, yeah, and. The fault would address only the process that wrote to the page, right? And the second process, when it tries to access its own page, will cause another fault, and that would fetch the original version of the page.
I see.
And that should be a non-blocking operation.
So what you're saying is that
this is like a
instead
like
of pointing to the same page, we point to the same
location on disk. Well, no longer, it doesn't become the same location on disk anymore because let's go through this a little
slowly, right? Because we have to make sure that this is correct before we agree on a design. I think that the challenge is to handle this in a non-blocking fashion if we can. Mm-hmm. And if we can do it, then we can do it in the hand.
By the way, I was going to say that I mean, it makes sense to make a design, but actually, I don't think we have to implement, right? I think it can get complicated, and I don't know if it will have much benefit.
Yeah, actually, I have that question. How often does this happen?
Yeah.
Not so much. The only issue I've had with it is the kernel won't boot if you put like low enough memory. So if you boot something kind of heavy and you only get like 100 megabytes, when it starts forking processes at the beginning, the kernel will just hang.
Hmm.
But if you give it enough memory and then use Lewis's balloon, it works just fine.
But
for the base.
Yeah, but not only that. I mean, because we need to boot with low in memory, right?
Yeah.
So what we can do is that we detect that case and make it block, and that's it. As long as it doesn't, as long as
you
it
mean,
doesn't
okay.
happen that much, right?
I agree that
we need to discuss that in the paper and at least have a solution.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
We need to have a solution. I think that's important. And so, okay, so what I was thinking is that we have two processes, right, P1 and P2, right? And they have two structures each. One is the page table structure, and the other is, the, I guess, they call the swap map or something like that. Is that how this... Or
I think the swap cache is just one thing.
It's just one for the entire...
Yeah.
Okay. And
for just pages, though.
Okay, so let's make...
What, that's process one and process two?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, nice.
And there are page tables, right, for both of these guys.
Okay.
And then some of these are pointing to the swap map. Is that how this works?
That would be the swap.
Swap cache. Is that what you're saying?
The pages themselves are the one. Yeah.
But these are pointers.
If it's pointing to the swap cache, it's because the page is already in memory.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's, you know...
It's already in
because
memory.
Because it's in the process of being read in
it's
memory.
It's either in memory or it's in the process of getting...
What
memory.
About the locations on disk?
The locations on disk are usually on the page table itself.
Here?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So... Okay, so this is not important.
Okay. Yeah, I think the subcache is
trying to. Yeah. Okay, so let's say that this page table is two tuple where I have disk locations and I have
uh-huh.
array locations. Right?
Uh-huh.
So what we have is a situation where two of these guys are pointing to same location on disk, right?
Yep.
Same location on disk.
Mm-hmm.
And then P1 has a write fault.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, hold on. So for a copy and write operation, the page table gets copied as is, right? So which means that the swap entries also get copied.
Mm-hmm. That would make sense. Yeah.
That would make sense.
Probably for fork.
Yeah, for fork. If it's a copy and write fork,
yeah.
the whole
thing gets copied as of
yes.
that.
Yes.
Right? So that's why we have the situation
right.
in the first place. Okay. So now P1 has a write fork,
mm-hmm.
and since this is a copy and write page, we have to create a copy of the page before we allow the write to go through for P2. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we're doing is we are creating a patch, right? And issuing an IO to get this page.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Which means that
once this page is written, this entry will be invalidated, right? So which means
yes.
that you don't need this pointer anymore. So this should be invalid, correct?
This is what is happening right now or what should happen?
No, this is what is happening right now.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Is that approximately what happens?
Yeah.
But I think both get invalidated, right?
No, just one, whichever faults first.
But the pointer to disk, I think both get invalidated.
Oh, no, yeah, they both get invalidated. The pointer, once it gets read in.
Once it gets read in and a copy is created, then this guy would get invalidated.
Yes.
Yes.
So what we could do is change that in the following way, that when we create a patch, we wait for this page to get read in, right? And then after the page is written, only invalidated one of these guys.
Mm-hmm.
So only invalidated this guy, so this still stays valid. This pointer to this still stays valid.
Yeah,
so so when it writes to the page, it will read the original pristine version of the page.
That makes sense. So it does, but the thing is that these happen. So in our case, well, in the normal case, this all happens in I guess one sequence because it blocks in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
In our case, we block on the upper half, and then we defer the second half. So it's and we apply the patches and interrupt context.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, we can't mess with any of these because they get.
So you're saying we are modifying the completion handling of a page, which is copy on write, and
so
that's something we don't mess with yet.
Yeah, well, it's something that it gets done once the completion handler for the IO itself is done.
Yes. So one thing which we could do is to kind of...
So I guess we would have to have some sort of flag and set that ahead of time.
Yes. Well, that's one. To either set a flag to say, okay, this is a special case and it needs to be handled differently than a regular copy and write page.
Mm-hmm.
Alternatively, we could just make that page non-copy and write. If we figure out which flag there is, tells me whether it's a, you know, that's a copy and write page, we can make it non-copy and write, and that's okay because the copy exists on disk.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then it would get handled as before.
But then we have to make sure that that we don't remove that entry and we don't reuse the space on this.
Yes, yeah, we have to be careful about that. So there has to be something...
I think there is a structure called swap entry.
Yeah, there's a swap entry.
So that swap entry is for what? Per page, per DMA, per page.
Mm-hmm.
So the page has a... The page structure has a swap entry.
There's a way to get it. I don't think the page itself holds it directly.
Okay.
So I'd have to look in the code that looks for it.
But this is an option.
I mean, yeah, I think it's a good option.
Because then we don't need to block for anything.
We're doing a copyright. It's like a copyright at the disk.
At the disk level, because
the
page
disk
is
level
blocked.
Instead of the memory level.
Yes.
I think that's fine.
It's something to think about. But
yeah.
That seems like a... I mean, at the very least, we need to have a design that we can discuss in the paper. And so think about this and see if there are any problems with it.
Mm-hmm.
Or some gray simulation or something.
So in this case, we would have to get that page, and then once we have the page, then we would need to check all the mappings for the page, and then validate those, or invalidate one of them.
And by the way, the other day we were talking about this ordering thing, which came to mind I think a couple of days ago to me, and I wasn't sure if we had the minor faults design, whether we address the ordering correctly for all cases.
What was the ordering?
So let's say you have a bunch of patches that you need to apply to a page,
mm-hmm.
and then there is a, and then, you know, we bring in the page, we apply the patches. So is it possible that, so the operation of bringing the page in and applying the patches, is that guaranteed to be atomic?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Atomic with respect to what?
With respect to
writing from user space.
Or minor faulting on that same page.
Yeah, because the page is still locked, and the and since it runs an interruption context, it won't run all the way through.
Yeah, it won't, okay. It won't stop till everything's done.
So I guess the key is that it's locked. That's why
the phase lock is held and it's atomic.
Right, so Minofaux will not get handled until after this computes. Yeah.
What will happen is I should do a check for that. So if I see the page was read in, so I try to, there's a lock just for non-blocking writes.
Hmm.
So when I get that lock, if I see that the page is up to date, which means it's been read in, then I can just do the normal handling because the lock page won't block.
Right.
Which is what I just let it do.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, this is going through all kinds of cases in my mind. To make sure that, first of all, applying the patches immediately, that's okay too. Although there may be some other process that's blocked on a read on that page, that's still okay, right?
Yeah, because it has to wait until the completion of the IO handler, which also applies the patches.
What I'm saying is that, let's say you had a read and the process blocked, and some of the processes did a few more writes to the same page. And we queued all those patches in, right?
Yeah, what we said is that...
Do these processes need to synchronize out the band?
I mean, in the few writes that happen after the read has to block.
That's only in the same process. But if it's in a different process, then they won't block. You just create the patches.
Right.
But that's still okay. I mean, the ordering of the read and write operations is not...
Yeah, if you don't have some kind of locking mechanism yourself,
but then you can
guarantee it anyway.
If it's in the same process, that case won't happen, right?
If it's in the same process, then then we are
because,
okay.
Because when the read...
you don't have proper locking.
Exactly. But when the read happens, it will block, so you cannot write.
If it's one...
Well, at least that thread, because another thread could try to write to the same thing.
Yes.
In that case,
I guess it's fine because the operating system does not guarantee any ordering.
Yeah.
I think that's the case we discussed last time.
Yeah, and also I think we discussed that if the applications want to synchronize that case, it will use some user space synchronization.
Yes.
I think I wrote that down somewhere.
Okay. Okay, so I guess we can handle copy and write pages this way. We don't need to implement it, but we need to discuss it in our design.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Are there any other such special cases? What are the other kinds of pages, page states? I mean, one is a copy and write.
There is a zero page, but that's just
zero page.
An allocation. So non-blocking writes not involved there.
And the zero page meaning that...
it's just a blank page that gets created.
Yeah,
allocated.
I mean, you mean more stacks, so you allocate a new page.
Okay.
I think there is some more.
There's a couple. I guess we check the list of flags we can see all. I know there's one that's HW poison. That one has to do with hardware, but I think that's just for memory map hardware.
The poison is for... It's when the hardware is there's something wrong with it, I think. So if that page is in a bad state, it marked that page is in bad state and don't use it anymore.
Okay. Oh, so some memory corruption.
Yeah. Okay. But I think we can ignore that.
I think it'll get detected anyways.
We don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Okay, good. So except for the copy and write, we have everything else implemented as per what we discussed last time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, cool. I just need to test it all.
So I guess what you need to do with a copy and write is just detect the copy and write case.
And
if that is the case, don't do the non-blocking write, just one.
Mm-hmm.
Just follow the normal path. And I think that will solve the problem.
Okay.
I would say that the other thing is that try to count how many times that happened just to make sure it's not very frequently.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And we are not missing performance because of that.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. So Louis, how are things going with your file system implementation?
I was having some problems with, for some reason I was doubling the number of files. So what I did to debug the system was to have two cases. One case where I had a lot of paging, and the other case where I don't have paging at all, right? So in the case of paging at all, what you would expect is that unblocking Rust would take exactly the same amount of time than the other one.
And the number of files as well?
Yes, and the number of files as well, right? So not exactly. Well, not exactly the same amount of time because you have the asynchrony part, but I think that doesn't happen. Actually, non-blocking writes didn't show up in that case. So in Postmark, it seems like non-blocking writes doesn't happen that much if you have enough memory.
When you say
it's
that,
probably because of sequential writes.
What was that?
It's probably because of sequential writes and the pages are getting prefetched.
Yes, could be. Could be because of the prefetching. And what I meant, it doesn't happen that much, is that it doesn't happen at all.
Okay, let's say that then.
Yes. Yeah. That's a better term.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's all here in my log of statistics. Right, so in that case, even in that case, the IOs were, I mean, it was slower. It was, I don't remember the exact times, but it was much slower. I think it was twice the time.
With no non-blocking writes.
From Manila with non-blocking writes.
Mm-hmm.
So that was odd. And what I found was that, I don't know if you remember that we, for some reason, at the beginning of the process implementation, we were blocking on the block device. The problem was that there was not enough spots in the scheduler in order to hold all the outstanding IOs that we generated because of non-blocking writes.
But I thought there were no non-blocking writes in this case.
There was not, but I was reserving a huge amount of memory for those requests in the scheduler.
But
right?
That should have been done for vanilla as well, or no?
No, because in vanilla case, they said that the maximum amount of requests that you could have in the scheduler is 128, and guarantees 4, exactly. And what I did was to change it to 4,000, which is, you know, huge, and then I guaranteed 4,000. So it was pre-allocating 4,000 requests in memory.
4,000 times
the structure size. I don't know how much was that. But apparently it was affecting the performance. So that amount of memory now compared to vanilla was not dedicated to file system cache. And what happened there is that there was more IO happening. Right?
Because of the reserve space.
Because of the reserve space. So what it did is to shrink that to its vanilla size and everything went back to normal. At least in the 1 gigabyte case. Right.
But that's kind of odd because 4,000 is, how big can the request structure be? 100 bytes at most? I mean, can it be more than that?
Yeah.
4,000 times 100 is 400 kilobytes out of 1 gigabyte. It's surprising that that would affect performance by half, right? I mean, or you said the time was twice as much. It's very surprising to me.
No, it's 4 minutes, right? Well, I guess it's not much.
4,000 requests. 4,000 times 100 bytes.
Yeah,
it's not 4 megs. It's 400 kilobytes.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
But even if it's 4 megs,
yeah, it's not much.
So
maybe it's from, maybe, I guess it's pulling out from, like, one giant batch of memory that it uses. But even then, using only 400K out of it, well, actually, that's a couple hundred pages.
But it's not much, I mean, relative to 1 gig.
Yeah, it's true.
I don't know.
I don't know how big the file is.
Apparently, that was affecting the performance. So when I reduce that, probably...
I mean, I don't think 400K will affect the performance.
Yeah.
There's probably something we are missing.
Okay, exactly. That's your point. I mean, there was some interaction with the scheduler or something happening.
Yeah, exactly. Or, yeah, it may
well,
be...
Well, how big actually can the file system get?
the question is, I guess the operating system can use the whole memory for cache.
Yeah, it could. It could, yeah.
Yeah, well, anyway, so apparently that solved the problem, at least in that scenario. So, having solved that, I moved to the scenario where I have only 128 megabytes of memory, which is half of the working set of the Postmark, right? So in that case, first I was having this problem where the operating system was running out of memory, and there is this daemon called kBlockD that wasn't able to allocate memory, so the system was crashing, right?
And in the vanilla case?
There was, no, in the vanilla case it worked fine, in the non-lock and write case. And the reason was that I was allocating memory for patches with GFP Atomic.
Oh, okay. The problem we're using the atomic one is a result.
So the problem with the GFP Atomic is that it's using emergency pool.
Yeah.
So I was completely taking the whole emergency pool, and there was nothing else for the rest of the system.
Did you use GFP no IO?
I use GFP no IO, but the problem with using GFP no IO is that it could deadlock because I am allocating memory. Mm-hmm. Sorry, you're right, no IO. I used no IO, but it didn't work for some reason.
Because I was using GFP kernel, and sometimes that one would block.
Yes, would block. So then it would deadlock. That was the case I was talking about. But with no IO, it didn't work either, and I don't remember why. Anyway. So
actually, you're in the final system, so you should be using OFS, right?
Say that again?
You should be using OFS, because in that case, it'll try to avoid another file system call, because it could do another write if it tries to do a file system write.
Right.
Yeah, because it'll try to swap out a page, and that's another write, and then I guess you might see as another non-blocking write.
Mm.
Yeah,
try to allocate a patch for that, and then that fails, so it goes back.
Oh, no, you stop at that point, right? You basically would deadlock.
Yeah, it'll just keep calling itself recursively.
Well, oh, yeah, it's a recursive live lock.
Yeah, well,
there was a problem with no IO, and actually, they didn't try in OFS, or in OFS will come. Yeah, anyway, so the one I tried was one that's called GFP no wait.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is that that one doesn't use emergency pool, but use something else. And that worked fine, but actually it could crash, because no wait means that it could fail. I'm saying, okay, you can fail, no problem,
but I have a bull gone.
No, I have a bull gone. So what would happen is that if you can allocate the memory, it would crash. But so far it hasn't happened. So
For me, I just check and see if the allocation returned null, that means it couldn't return anything, so I just let it do the normal behavior.
Exactly, that's what I was planning to do, but it just, was more code.
For me, it's like two lines or three lines.
For me, it
prints out the error, and then it just does the normal.
Yeah, for me, it's more than that, so I just let it go. So that solved the allocation memory problem, the memory allocation problem. But now, I'm drawing into this problem where, again, the non-blocking write case is slower than the vanilla case. Now, in this case, there is a lot of non-blocking write happening.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking at it. I don't know exactly what the problem is.
Do you see the block trace?
I'm looking at the block trace.
And I was also wondering initially, right, when you said that you changed the IOQ to be much smaller,
yes,
the problem went away. And when the problem existed and the span was twice, did you look at the block trace to see?
Yes, and I have the block trace. And where I found was just that the number of files were doubled.
In which case, the original?
No, in the non-blocking write case.
Right, in the non-blocking write case, when you had 4,000 requests in the queue.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the problem is not with respect to memory. I think there might be something else, because I find it hard to believe that when you reduce or use 400 kilobytes more memory, you need twice as much IO in Postmark.
Mm-hmm.
there may be some other case where, or some other portion of your code that issues requests by mistake twice, or something like that. That to me seems more likely.
Yeah, it seems more likely to me too. I have been looking into into that to see if I'm generating more IELTS.
Mm.
But the thing is that I was...
That's why I recommended you check at the addresses as well to see if you're issuing the same request twice.
Yeah, yeah.
Or if you're issuing all unique requests, or even if you're issuing the same request, if they're sort of well
yes.
separated out in time, that's
right.
probably also okay. But if you're issuing the same request back to back...
I look into that and it works.
Can the IELTS scheduler even let you do that? If you submit the...
This could be the previous IO completes
and
then the same request again.
Okay.
Right? Something like that.
Yeah, I look into the... I calculate the reuse distance
mm-hmm.
of accesses and it was more free... I mean, the reuse distance was much smaller in the non-blocking drive case. But my concern was... I mean, I understand that could mean that I'm sending the I again, but I don't think so because of two reasons. First, now that we have much more IOs,
mm.
it makes sense that the reuse distance would be smaller, right?
But I guess the question is how small? Precisely how small?
What
was the most commonly occurring reuse distance or few reuse distances? Was it
yeah.
like 10 or...
No,
I think that's the...
No, it was from 200 up.
200. And what was it before?
Like 4,000 or something.
Mm-hmm.
Or 2,000. No.
Right, so that's a factor of 10.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that I did a version of non-blocking write where I have this knob to turn R on or off non-blocking writes.
Mm-hmm.
So when I turn off non-blocking writes, it happened the same thing.
Mm-hmm. What?
When I turn off non-blocking writes, it happened the same thing.
What do you mean same thing? What is same thing?
Sends the same, the double amount of IOs.
Oh, so it's something to do with the kernel itself?
Yeah.
So there's some part of the kernel that...
Yeah, and that's how I found those 4,000. I said, okay, what's different here from running it, right? I'm not running my code. I'm not running anything else. So I said, okay, that changed its values and not worth it.
But the vanilla you're using, you compiled as well, right? Using the same config?
Using the same config, but not... but the block device has the same amount of requests, right?
Are you saying that the same kernel works very different? When you turn on non-blocking writes, that reverts back to the vanilla kernel, right?
It should, but apparently...
I mean, vanilla in the sense that it will run the vanilla code. But all my code is there.
Yeah, but it doesn't run. I mean,
but it doesn't run, yeah.
If it doesn't run, it's the vanilla kernel.
Yeah. I mean, there are some additional checks, like...
Unless there's a lot of branching.
There's a lot of if
mm.
it's non-blocking, right, then do this. But that won't run because I'm not setting the page to be non-blocking, right? That's the additional code that would run.
Just the additional checks.
Just the additional ifs.
I mean, that would be a performance hit, but I don't see it being like a 2x performance hit.
Yeah, no.
But, and not just that, you're doing twice as many
exactly,
IOs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or a way
that
more
in
IOs.
General.
So that's weird.
What about the size of the IOs?
I don't know the size of the IOs. What I did was I print the total amount of blocks read, or actually accessed, read or written. And they were doubled. As well.
Oh, number of pages, or number of blocks. Yeah.
Number of blocks. I mean, number of 512 bytes block.
Okay.
I add up all that
hmm.
and bring that.
And that's twice.
And that was twice.
And the number of IOs were also twice, or?
Yeah, it was more or less twice.
Hmm.
It actually was something like from 300 to 500 or something like that. 300,000 blocks, mm-hmm. or I think, to 500,000 blocks.
Oh, that's not twice.
Sorry. No, no blocks. Ks. I don't remember divided by two.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so from 300 megabytes mm-hmm. to 500 megabytes. So I'm reading 200 megabytes more.
Just to refresh that, it just happens for postmark small, doesn't happen for the large postmark size.
I haven't tried that because small takes a lot of time already, so I haven't tried.
Okay. So you said you didn't see any prefetches, the prefetches I was talking about, right?
Say that again?
Remember, we were talking about the prefetches, these large prefetches, these
yeah.
two-meg prefetches.
Okay.
Have you checked that?
No, but, I mean, that prefetches shouldn't affect that, right?
Are you running it under QMU, or...?
Yeah, it should,
KVM.
Because...
Okay.
If the working set is very small, and if that prefetch is in 2 meg, then there is no point of using the locking guides, right?
But... I mean, when what I said is that when I'm using the 1 gigabyte memory, there is no non-blocking writes. I mean, the memory is so big that non-blocking writes doesn't happen.
Well, that's maybe because of that.
That's fine. Even that is fine. What I'm saying is that even in that case, the amount of files double. Right?
Yeah, but that can also explain because of that, right?
No. Why?
Wait, let's have some
because,
subject
I mean,
object
it depends,
because
what, it depends how do you count IOs.
Say that again?
What is that?
It depends how do you count IOs. Okay, that is that. The thing is that I was looking at the non-blocking write for the MMAP pages, and what I saw is that There is prefetching for sequential streams, but there is also prefetching for random accesses. So if the kernel detects that there is a random access, it starts prefetching in 2 megabyte blocks. And if this prefetching doesn't work, it starts doing it. But if it's working, and that could happen if the working set is very small, it brings pages in blocks of 2 megabytes.
Okay.
So in that case, there is no use for non-blocking writes. So in that case, what I saw is that by having non-blocking writes enabled or disabled, you have just the exact same time because you're bringing the 2 megabytes bunch of pages, and if you're working with, what, let's say, 100 megs, then there is no difference.
Right. That's true. I mean,
if these are large files, yes.
You mean that in the case of vanilla and non-blocking writes, they will both have exactly the same time, right? Execution time.
Yeah.
Well, if there is some overhead, that will be the non-blocking writes overhead because of our code, right?
Right.
But
even if prefetching is present, right?
Yes.
So what was happening is that the time was not the same.
Yes, I mean, what I'm saying is that there could be some overhead, right?
Okay. What? Okay. Yeah, I mean...
And especially if you detect this non-blocking write, right? And then you submit an IO. Let's say before the IO is submitted, the vanilla kernel was submitting a very large IO. But now you're submitting this asynchronous IO that you're submitting is in 4K.
I didn't get that. What was the problem there?
Okay, let's say the kernel, in your path, in the file system path, let's say the kernel, for some reason, sees that it would be better to send the current IO,
mm-hmm.
the current read because of a write, in a large request.
Okay. Just to do prefetching, let's say.
Okay, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But you won't send that large request. You're sending a 4K request.
Okay.
Okay, just that. Just stop there. That would affect performance, right?
But not in the vanilla case when there's enough. Well, in the vanilla case, it should run if he just removes the code that sets the non-blocking rights flag.
Hmm.
So the IOs are coming from somewhere.
No, but hold on. I mean,
yeah.
The prefetching is happening in non-blocking rights as well, right?
Yeah. At least it should.
Yeah, but in that case, okay. So the point I'm trying to make is that by having non-blocking rights, you might be affecting the prefetching. You might be reducing the prefetching. That's what I'm trying to say.
Hmm.
Well, the prefetching happens when the IO gets submitted in the first place.
Yes.
So the IO is going to be submitted anyways. It's just when it gets handled is different.
No, I think Ricardo's point, if I understand correctly,
okay.
is the point at which you intercept the write request.
Okay.
Is it before the issuing of the prefetch or after?
Yes.
Is that a good way to ask your question, Ricardo?
Yes.
If you have the page, it should have already been.
I think it doesn't matter, right?
No, it matters a lot. Because if you intercept the write before the prefetch request is created,
okay.
Then your system
is
effectively preempting the prefetch.
Well, the thing is, the prefetch is going to happen either way, and it's going to be the same size no matter what.
Because
he's still going to issue his IO,
exactly.
And the prefetching is going to grab.
I'm not affecting the way IOs are sent, right? I'm just saying
from the application or the prefetcher, because the prefetching is
it's
okay.
Just one call, I think.
So if I understand this correctly, right? Mm-hmm. So the application performs right in our case. And then this goes into the kernel, right? And then at some point, so the VFS does a few things, and then at some point there is a piece of code that figures out what should be the size of the actual IO request it is,
mm-hmm.
right? So once this write comes in here, so this may be X, right? And this may be a lot more, X plus some few pages, right? Because it's prefetching additional pages.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, where do you intercept the request and perform the non-blocking write?
So let's say that I'm doing up in the in
here.
The, okay, there. What
happens? If you do here, right,
mm-hmm.
And you find a page, if you implement non-blocking writes before the prefetch, right, we create a patch, you issue one request.
Okay.
Right.
Well, you still issue requests through the regular path,
yeah.
though, which is
so
what I was
saying.
So you
still go through here?
Yeah. Same.
I'm not affecting the path how the IOs are sent.
And attaches it to the page.
The IOs are sent exactly the same. It's just that I'm not waiting for the IO. That's it.
Okay, that's the expected behavior, right? But you're clearly affecting the number of files because you're telling us that you have doubled the number of files. The expected behavior is that you send the exact number of files, right? But you're not, so that's why we're trying to explain.
I mean, that's fine, but I think, I don't know if that is a problem. As I said, when I change the size of the scheduler, that also, for some reason, changed the size of the number of files that I send to the block device, right? And that didn't have to do anything with non-blocking rights. Okay, so that was one point. Now what I was saying is that when I have 128 megabytes, for some reason I have additional IOs, and I am incrementing the time from 800 seconds to 1,000 seconds.
Are they all
okay? So we are trying to explain why you have more IOs.
That's
had a possible time. Explanation. Maybe it failed, but. And that's the direction we should be taking, like trying to explain what's going on.
Which IOs are being issued? I think we need to understand that.
Yeah. Is it a lot of reads or extra writes?
No, I think the proportion between reads and writes are the same.
Okay.
I think we need to go a little deeper, which is precisely which requests are being issued, addresses. Right. So if you do a timeline of both,
right.
And then you try to match one timeline with the other timeline to see which requests may be going out. Maybe there are some duplicates that are being issued,
mm-hmm.
right? And when are they being issued? Why are they being issued, right? I think that's what we need to try and understand.
Yeah. If anything, I could take a look at the code and see if there's anything that maybe we've missed from looking at Polymer today.
Yeah, but I think you're addressing the prefetch, so prefetch
yeah.
is not being affected.
Yeah, because
I just think it might just be some kind of weird.
Even if I do it down below the prefetch, even in that case, the prefetch is handled.
Well, you cannot. I guess you cannot do it below the prefetch because
that's
it's a read
true.
Call.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
a read
yeah.
call. It's not a write call.
So I guess my point is I'm not affecting the path that much.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing I'm doing is to not blocking.
So you allow the same path to continue, so the same prefetch mechanism should be engaged?
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense. So, and Ricardo, by the way, your explanation actually does not work because it explains how the number of IOs reduce.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And in Lewis's case, we
no,
have
no.
more IOs.
No, no, I mean, depends how do you count these IOs, right? If you don't count prefetch's IOs, or you're counting,
well,
that was also different. Another question I had, where you counting this?
No, the place, and because I'm running KVM, right? So
yeah.
I am tracing, I'm doing block trace at the host level, so it should see all arrows, absolutely all arrows.
Okay, and also, the size of the IOs, because the example I was referring to was that originally you have few large IOs, but now you have lots of small IOs.
So what I said is that to address that, I'm counting the number of megabytes that I'm reading and writing.
Right. I think it's important. Both are important.
Mm-hmm.
The total data in terms of megabytes as well as the number of IOs.
I think both
need to be preserved somehow.
So what is happening is that the amount of IOs are incremented, right? And also the amount of megabytes I'm reading and writing are incremented.
But is it the same fraction?
I think it's the same fraction.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean that you're not fragmenting IOs, right?
The average in that case, the average request size will be the same, right?
But it's not the same to send two IOs and one IO, right? Even if they're bringing the same data.
No, I mean, if they are both incrementing in the same proportion, that means that in average the IO has exactly the same size.
I think that's the key point here, that the average IO size is not changed.
The average IO size is not changed. That's true, but
okay.
Well, yeah, but you could be averaging both stream cases, and then you get the average.
Yeah, you can create averages in the same way for different distributions, is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's possible. Yeah. So that's why I think it's important to look at the addresses and the sizes of IOs. I mean, you don't have to do it for the entire trace. You know, just take one section and make an observation, maybe in the beginning of the trace, and see what might be going on, right? To get a better understanding of maybe some case that you hadn't thought about, but is being exercised in the code that's generating all these additional IOs. I think that's the key problem right now, is that there is a lot more IO going on, and that's going to take more time, right?
Yeah.
If you figure out why that's happening and how to get rid of it, I think we'll be ahead a little bit.
Yeah.
I think examining the code, yeah, certainly we have to do that, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it would be better if we have a more informed starting point to look at the code.
It would be
right.
nice to know where each IO is coming from. But I mean, it's hard to get them to.
Yeah, once you call dump stack every single time an IO gets stressed, and that's a lot of data.
Yeah,
I think that may be challenging. But at least we can look at the addresses and sizes and the point in time where IOs get issued. That might give you some some insight.
Well, is there an easy way to disable prefetching?
I think if you just comment out like this.
I think it is, but then, I mean, we would have to disable in both cases.
No. That's funny. It's just for understanding this behavior and, you know, at least for the first version to have a simplified system that we can understand.
I don't think there is a good reason to think that prefetching is a problem, right?
Especially when there's no non-blocking rights happening.
But at least that's the best explanation I can have, because I mean the only two
prefetching
way prefetching request is that when an application does this, which you are not affecting, at least you're pretty sure you're not affecting, and prefetches, right?
The only way I see prefetches affecting anything is if there's a low memory case and we're prefetching a lot of pages that we don't need, so that in that case it might help non-blocking rights. But this isn't the case where there's plenty of memory and there's no non-blocking rights happening, and it's still taking longer.
Actually, it's the other way around. In the big memory,
mm-hmm.
non-blocking rights is not happening. I mean, the problem is not happening anymore.
Oh, okay. So in the low memory case.
In the low memory case is where it's happening.
Okay, so free.
So in the big memory case, mm-hmm. The problem was solved by reducing the amount of the scale size.
Okay.
So the other curious thing is that when you disabled all the code for the non-blocking rights and introduced maybe a few additional checks, you still see the exact same behavior in terms of number of I/O requests, let me finish, and the total size of data read. Is that correct? As you would with non-blocking rights enabled. That's the weirdest thing. So,
that couldn't even explain because of the same thing. I mean, you're saying fragmented IOs, but you're fragmenting them.
Ricardo, but there's no change. Yeah. I mean, nothing changes because the non-blocking rights code is not being exercised at all.
The only thing that's happening
is... it's clearly being exercised, because otherwise you would have the same time as vanilla.
So you think that maybe there was some corner case that Lewis left out in disabling
No, it's not corner. What I'm saying is that, let's say, for example, the prefetching stuff, the size of the block. Now all blocks you're sending for non-blocking rights, there is because of non-blocking rights, are 4K. Before they were supposed to be larger.
Hmm. Okay.
Well, I don't see the IO path being affected, though.
I think the basic...
Yeah.
I see the basic difference in opinion is that Lewis thinks that the IO path is not changed.
Mm-hmm.
And Ricardo thinks that the IO path is
that's
changed.
That's the expected behavior, but that's clearly being changed. Otherwise, we'll have the same time as vanilla.
Yeah.
Let's not worry about time, because time is affected because of other overheads.
Because of the number of IOs.
But let's just look at the number of IOs and the total
amount
of data.
Of
okay, that has to be preserved if the IO path is not being changed, correct? And that's
okay,
not being preserved.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that means that the IO path has been
changed. The IO path is being changed.
But when I change the scalar size, everything goes back to normal.
But in the low memory case?
In the low memory case, it doesn't.
Yes. Okay, let's focus on the low memory case now.
But
let's about the high memory case.
No, but hold on. I mean... changing the number of IOs doesn't mean that the IO path is affected, right? I mean, it's just that more IOs are generated.
Right.
I mean, you're not changing correctness, but you are changing something.
Okay.
You have different results. You're clearly changing something, right?
Are you changing the benchmark? No. Right? Uh-huh. The workload is exactly the same set of read and write system calls are coming from
the
application.
In fact, the results... in terms of how many reads and how many megabytes and so on, are exactly the same.
Wait.
So if you have the same number of data and the same proportion of frequency, like, then you're fragmenting it.
Hold on. Wait, something just changed in what you just said.
No, it didn't change. The report of the postmark is exactly the same in both cases in terms of
At the application level. Oh, yeah, that will stay the same.
Yeah.
All the mess is happening inside the kernel, right?
Right.
So, and that mess is going to the disk as well.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so that,
I think we need to figure out what is the source of that additional additional IOs in terms of number as well as the data, additional data that is being read or written.
Right. So in terms
and that means, if that's different, that means the IO path inside the kernel has been affected somehow.
There's something inside the kernel that is happening. That's clear. I'm not saying that, I mean, there's nothing magical happening generating the IOs, right?
Right, so...
I'm sure it's non-blocking writes because...
No, it's not, because you disabled all the non-blocking write code. And still it's happening, right? I mean, am I correct about that?
That's happening in the big memory case.
Whoa, no, so in the small...
Okay, so let's talk about the big memory case. In the small case, I don't have all the tests yet. In the small memory case, I was just running the case with non-blocking writes disabled. I don't have those results yet.
Okay.
With the big memory case, I have all the results.
Okay.
And all the results are three cases, vanilla, non-blocking writes, and non-blocking writes disabled.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Once I reduce the scalar size to be from 4,000 to be 128, all the three of them behave exactly the same, which is expected.
Hmm.
Okay? In the small memory case, the non-blocking write case is having a lot more IOs than vanilla case.
Hmm.
And the non-blocking write disabled for small memory, I don't have results yet.
Right. But do we expect...
My expectation is that it would be the vanilla and non-blocking write disabled would be the same. If they are not,
but
there is something wrong happening, right?
I see. Yeah, it should be the same.
But
why did you bring it up then? I mean, why did you bring up this case of even though non-blocking writes were disabled, the behavior stays the same?
Because there is something outside non-blocking writes happening. I mean, there was something about the size of the scalar.
Okay.
That is affecting something in the number of files that I don't understand.
Okay, so this is not a concern then. I mean, I don't see the disabling of the non-blocking writes creating some phantom effects that cannot be explained, right?
Until now, that we don't have that behavior. Okay. When I reduce the size of the kernel, everything went back to normal.
Okay. All right, that makes me feel much better.
Because the one thing, though, is that non-blocking writes, since we're adding so much asynchrony to the write path, that we're issuing a lot more IOs, and since we're in low memory, then whenever we want to queue something else, so when we filled up those four requests, if we want to queue up a fifth one, we have to wait for memory to allocate that fifth one, and so on.
By the way, in your test, you're changing the scalar, the IO scalar size?
No.
So it's not vanilla.
Well, right now I'm just doing testing since I changed the code.
So. Yeah, I just wanted to know if to see the benefits of non-blocking write was required to change the scalar size.
Yeah.
Apparently it's not going.
It doesn't seem like it. I think the path has enough memory reserves to allocate for the ones on it. The four is guaranteed, but it shouldn't be an issue getting more memory.
Okay. Yeah. That makes sense.
Okay.
I mean, once we have more stability in your code and we know everything works as expected, then we could play around with that.
Yeah,
that was one thing I was playing around with before.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. So what is the plan of action? I mean, Lewis, do you have anything in mind in particular that you wanted to do next?
Well, I wanted to find this problem.
How?
I
guess the question is how? What is your path?
So my next step was to compare non-blocking write disabled with vanilla and see that they are both the same.
Let's say that happens.
So in that case, then I guess I don't know what to do next.
Okay, block trace, right? I mean, look at block trace. And
no, I have the block trace already.
I'll take a walk through the code hopefully today. And see if maybe I find some weird condition where you're issuing an extra IO where you shouldn't be.
Yeah, but at least we need to get a sense for what extra IOs are we issuing. We don't even know that.
Mm-hmm.
We just know that there are extra IOs, but we don't know what, right? And block trace can tell us what those extra IOs where, or doesn't tell us where it is coming from, but what those extra IOs are. And by knowing what those extra IOs are, maybe we can speculate better where they are coming from. That's my recommendation.
It's hard to find in the code. We can always use, there's a way to check what the caller is for each write. So I guess we could check the stack and I guess keep a list of all the methods that are calling that are issuing IOs and count how many are being issued from each path.
For instance, if we know a specific address is always repeated, we can use that, the value of that address in the code to determine where it is coming from. Right? Dump stack frame when the address matches this address, and then see where it's coming from.
Okay.
Yeah, because it seems like you are at this point you're sort of stuck, right?
Yeah.
With this issue.
Yeah.
And if Jesus and Ricardo can get more involved to help you, I think that would be better. I think Jesus is almost done, right, with whatever you're doing.
Yeah, I need to do a bit of checking. I wrote most of the code by hand, so we'll see.
And I guess Ricardo is already working with you, I mean, together with you, or?
More or less.
Yeah. Okay. All right, let's talk about the paper next.
Yeah, so I made a list of what is left in the paper. So the first thing is code, and so we need the code to work on motivation and evaluation. So mainly at this point, what is missing is motivation and evaluation. I think the rest of the paper were only text is required, like design.
But I think we need to do a few more improvements in terms of our descriptions, right?
Mm-hmm.
Based on what we discussed last week. And this new thing
Yes, absolutely. I think in either case, we didn't explain the paper, what we had before with the thread and so on. So
it would be
just a new content. I mean, before we weren't explaining the thread that we had before, the kernel thread that we were having before.
Yes. So
we just need to add the new thing.
Yeah, so we need a plan for where we need to add it. Right.
Yeah.
I
don't know. I think. Yeah. I wasn't sure if that was implementation or design. I think it should go in design.
Design,
I guess, should be a little bit more overall. So.
Yeah, because I mean that.
Well, in design, it should just be the regular explanation of non-blocking rights. Should probably go in implementation.
I guess
when we say, well, this is where we put this.
I guess the policy I chose to go in implementation and design was, it goes to design if it applies to all operating systems, and it goes to implementation if it applies to
to all
instances.
I don't think that's the best policy. I think the design should be more abstract at a conceptual level so that people understand quickly what the ideas are, without having to worry about the details. I think implementation is where we would, for instance, put the diagram we put last time. I think that makes more sense. And if you come up with a version of that diagram or this or
the new diagram. Of that diagram.
Oh, okay.
We can discuss that later.
I can make one a little more specific if we want to get into like the actual calls that are going on.
So maybe you guys can work together and come up with something more that you guys agree on, right?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't need to be like have all the details, but has to be
something
detailed enough so that people can appreciate the complexity or at least the control flow complexity of this problem. Right?
Yeah. So what I was thinking was something a little bit more detailed than, since we have this figure here, it's kind of an overall view of what happens.
Mm.
Something a little bit more detailed. So kind of what we did with some of the calls here and what goes on with the completion handling and all that.
Right. Right. There are at least three state diagrams. Right. One is when a process issues a write to a page that's not in memory. Right. The process issues a page that's in a non-blocking write already, right, and then the I/O completes for a non-blocking write page. So these, at least there are three different state diagrams that we could elaborate on.
Mm.
Okay. Okay, so I have here that we're mainly missing motivation, implementation, and evaluation. I saw the implementation, there was not much text there, and there was a lot of things missing.
Okay.
I added a bunch of to-dos on the last time I did a revision.
Yeah, the implementation we should address I don't know whether the ordering, maybe, I'm not sure if it goes into the implementation or not. I think that's a conceptual.
I was reading something about correctness.
Yeah.
Somewhere in there.
Yes, correctness was somewhere in here. We have a discussion section, which is basically non-blocking rights and audit context.
Hmm.
Is
there a correctness? There is a correctness.
Correctness,
I think it
should
be somewhere.
Yeah, I read it somewhere.
I think it's designed as well. Correctness.
Yeah.
So
I think in correctness, we had to address all the things that we had before,
yeah,
including the ordering and copy on write pages.
I think I have ordering I added when should the application finish. I think we have a discussion about that, which was if we should finish the application but leave the dirty pages there, or we should finish the applications once all the non-blocking rights are resolved.
Oh, no. I think the application should finish as early as possible.
That was a discussion we had.
I think the reason I asked you to check that is to see how many writes or how much delay there is after. That's the unfactored cost. But that doesn't mean we should implement it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The reason I told you to let's delay the application until all the writes complete is so we get an estimate of how much additional work gets done after the application completes.
Yeah,
No, but there was something else. I mean, I remember that what we discussed is that, because one of the concerns is that the non-blocking rights, that let's say that the application issues a bunch of non-blocking rights,
mm-hmm.
it finishes,
mm-hmm.
and after that there is non-blocking rights happening.
Mm-hmm.
Those non-blocking rights will affect applications that come afterwards.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So the question was,
So why should it affect the own application? Maybe it affects other applications, but should we let it affect another application, which is the application that issues the non-blocking rights?
Right.
There is no reason to.
Mm-hmm.
We are not spreading the pain, right? We are just adding one more guy to experience the same pain.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't help.
Yeah, but
the moral support.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I guess
that's true. So I think the reason I told you, maybe I didn't communicate well, the reason I told you that we could delay the application is for us to, maybe that was simpler for us to estimate the additional work that gets done after the application would otherwise complete.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Because how much time do other applications get affected? But that, no, that it shouldn't affect our
okay.
design.
Then the other point I added in correctness here, which I don't know if it's the best place, but anyway, was I think we need a subsection of working on memory pressure. I have had some problems with GFP kernel, GFP NOI, or GFP and so on.
I think that would go into the implementation.
And this would go into implementation, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
The copy and write could go into the correctness, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. So,
Even that could, I'm not sure, I'm sort of divided into where it should go.
I think we need to discuss something about the memory pressure and how we solve that.
Mm-hmm.
So at least say, I don't know, when we are on memory pressure, then in your case, which is the correct thing to do was, okay, if we cannot allocate a new patch, we follow the normal path where we wait and so on. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a good discussion we should have.
That's probably something, yeah, I think that's implementation specific.
Yeah.
Because in the general case, we already know that there's, if you think about it abstract, there's already memory pressure, there's already swapping. But the kernel itself has memory reserves. So.
Yeah. The other thing I added was that I found CPCE benchmark, which is a NoLTP benchmark, and there is an implementation for Postgres that is called DBT5. So I haven't tried yet, but it seems like it's not very hard to run, and I think it's very complete. It's not a beta or something like that, but it's very complete at this point. And actually, they test Postgres performance with that up
okay.
Benchmark. So the developers itself. Sorry.
Okay.
What else? One thing we left out in discussion was what happened with the file system metadata. In here, we talk about the non-blocking writes on the data itself, but we don't talk about the file system metadata in any place. So I think it's we should discuss that. What else? One thing we should discuss in the overhead case. Oh, by the way, at some point we discussed about the non-blocking rights overhead, and I remember that we talked about something else than memory and CPU, but I cannot remember that. The only thing I remember was what Ming was asking for, but
time, I guess,
which is then how the additional page faults affect performance, which is a valid question. My guess is that it won't affect that much. I mean, a page fault time compared to an IO time should be much smaller. But I guess we need to discuss that with actual numbers.
Yeah, Ming had some very interesting questions in your proposal, I think.
Introduce extra minor faults, which cause extra context switches.
Yeah, that was the problem. So we need to discuss that in the overhead section.
Right. But I'm saying in general, Ming had some basic questions about the whole approach itself, which I think was not answered very well in your proposal, right?
Okay.
Which is, I think the first thing he was arguing is that, well, operating systems don't do this non-blocking rights, or at least he thought the reason operating systems don't do it this way is because there is enough locality. So when you block on a page, it is okay to block because that blocking cost is amortized across multiple references in the future.
Okay.
Right? I think that was his first point, right? So how do we argue or write our paper in such a way that that's not, that's easily addressed if some reader has that concern in mind?
But I guess what we're saying is that we don't even have to pay that time.
Right. And then, of course, he said that, well, the cost of doing non-blocking writes is the additional page fault. So,
exactly.
So we have to address these together.
That's what I was saying. I mean, the only reason why non-blocking write would be beneficial if all the page faults that we do on that page at the end would be smaller than the cost of the IO that would happen in vanilla.
So the cost of creating all the patches and all the context versus blocking on the IO.
Blocking on the IO, exactly.
Right.
So I think in that case we answer both questions. Right?
Yes. Yes. So how do we measure that cost? We have to measure it in terms of time.
We have to measure it in terms of time.
So what is the page fault or handling time?
Right. That I don't know.
We would just have to, because what will happen is when time reports the time, it will report the user in kernel time. So essentially, we'll spend a lot less time in kernel time because in system time, because we just do we create a patch and then we immediately return to user space. Mm-hmm. So the user space time should go up and the system time should go down. And whatever differences we calculate from vanilla will be...
The user time should be the same, right?
The user time should be...
Because in user space, you execute the same instructions.
The user time
you don't
be
have
same.
Any additional instructions.
I mean, the thinking time is the same, right? It's just that the way you get
or
right,
the system time would change.
Yeah, the system time would change. Would the user space really change?
Because in user mode, you execute precisely
yeah.
the same instructions.
So
yeah,
one
yeah.
way we can do, I was thinking that an experiment to answer that question would be to measure the write call time in vanilla and in non-blocking writes.
What is the write call time?
The just in a user space process, do a write to the same page randomly, let's say. So the my idea was to create, let's see how much time
This is
or
a write system
patches.
Call? Are you talking about a write system
I'm
call?
Talking about the write system call. So my, I guess what I wanted to ask was how many patches do we need to create in order to have the same amount of time than an IO, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I measure the average time it takes to do a write call.
No, but with each write call, well, not in the file system case, but in the anonymous case, we also have a page fault, and that's additional time. So.
That's fine. But
mm-hmm.
even in that case.
So it's not just the cost of the creating the patch, but also
uh-huh.
handling the page fault, right?
That's fine. That's what I wanted when I'm measuring the time in the user space. So in the user space, what I will do is read TSC, right? Do the write, read TSC again.
Write system call.
Yeah. Or the
for an in-memory page.
For an out-of-memory page.
Oh, for an out-of-memory page.
Yeah, he wants to see how many non-blocking writes will happen in the same amount of time that it'll take an IO to complete.
Okay, but and that's going to be different, by the way, in the case of a write system call versus in the case of anonymous page. Because in the anonymous page, you have a page fault. The write system call, you don't.
Oh, right.
Well, technically, it would be, they're both act like system calls, so the overhead from the call would be about the same.
Should be about the same, that's true. That's true, because they have both interruptions and they have the same.
I think we should measure both of them separately,
yeah.
because...
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I agree, but...
For the paper.
Yeah, yeah, but I think they will both be more or less about the same amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that time makes sense.
So, Jesus, is there a way to measure the latency of page fault handling?
I can always check and see if the page isn't in memory, how long it takes for the IO to complete, for non-blocking writes.
This is just the interrupt handling latency.
So where we apply the patches or?
Yes.
Okay.
When we apply the patches or even just plain vanilla, right? When just interrupt handling latency or page
fault. Well, the interrupt handler itself for the IO completion is really slow. I mean, not really slow. It's really fast. It does like four things maybe.
Hmm. But what about the page fault interrupt handling?
The page fault handling, I can measure.
Is there an easy way to start a timer when there is an interrupt?
I could just measure the amount of jiffies before when it
oh, you
first, the first thing that when it first enters the page fault and the
right.
architecture specific,
hmm.
I can always just check the amount of jiffies there,
okay.
and then when it fully completes and it's going to return, I can. Just get the difference in jiffies.
Okay, I think if we can get that for both vanilla as well as when a page is in non-blocking write, I think that would be good.
Okay.
Right.
That
so
would be the time of the call handling.
Yes. Yeah, so there are two. The fault handling exactly.
But the problem is that doesn't account for the context switch.
Yes. So there is additional time for the context switch as well.
Oh, but you know what? Hold on, because. I mean, we have additional page faults, and that means that we also have additional CPU pipe flushing.
Pipeline
flushing,
mm-hmm.
which means that the user space call would be affected as well.
Yeah, I guess the question is, what is the order of magnitude we are talking about here, right? Are we talking about nanoseconds or microseconds?
Pipeline flushes are relatively quick, and the context switch is...
It's probably more expensive, yeah.
Well, the context switch only takes a couple maybe like 2 nanoseconds, which is relatively quick.
And then the just the interrupt handling latency, how many nanoseconds is that, right? I think it would be good to get a sense for what, you know, what are the orders of magnitude here.
It's hard to tell, for that. I'm not really sure of an easy way to measure that.
By the way, in the past paper, they showed some numbers for that.
Polling
versus something interrupt.
Oh, right. When poll is better than interrupt?
Okay.
Yeah.
That one, yeah.
Right. Yeah.
I'll look through that paper, see if there's any good numbers in there.
But that, I mean, those numbers doesn't have to do anything with baseballs, right?
I think it's talking about
time for interrupt handling.
Okay, but the interrupt handling is different than the ball handling.
Well, they both generate, they all generate interrupts, it's just how they execute is different.
But I think in the interrupt handle, you have to extra stuff.
It's the only paper that I didn't read.
I actually have to go.
Yeah. Oh, you're very late.
It's
I hope your professor doesn't mind you showing up at the end of the class.
There's a full class. There's 45 minutes. I'm not sure why.
Okay. All right. See you.
Are you still can continue or something, or we can just?
Yeah, we should. I think. I think we had to address that concern carefully.
I think we can address it with that.
Okay.
And actually, the experiment can even go to the. I was thinking that it probably makes sense as part of the motivation itself. Saying that, okay, I mean, it takes a lot of faults before. Before it doesn't make sense to do non-blocking bytes, okay?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I think that's the key message we need, and it's supported with data.
Mm-hmm. All right, so, yeah, I think, Lewis, you need to solicit more help, I guess, to get this moving quicker.
Yeah.
And I don't know if Ricardo is spending time with you on this, and if not, it would be a good
Ricardo
idea that he does.
Ricardo was focusing on the file system part of the fault handler. So,
file system, you mean the anonymous?
Yeah, because Jesus was mainly working on the anonymous part. So the file system part is at this point is not handled. As a non-blocking write case.
You mean the mapped?
The mmap to a file.
Wouldn't that be handled in the anonymous case?
No.
No?
Probably because I think it's a different path. It's not exactly the same path. And I don't know, probably Ricardo better knows about that.
I see.
Yeah, right now it seems, I mean, what I have right now is that, I mean, it detects whether it's backed by, I mean, you have a fault, you detect whether you're backed by a file or it's anonymous. If it's anonymous, it goes through some calls, and if it's file backed, it goes through different calls. But at both levels, I have pretty much the same info, so I'm ending up calling a Jesus function pretty much the same way.
Okay.
I mean, that makes sense, right?
Because
at the end, it doesn't matter where those pages are in disk, the handling in memory should be the same.
Yes.
That this copy and write stuff won't work.
Except the copy and write stuff, yeah.
But can you...
Yeah.
But wait a minute. Can you copy and write a memory mapped page?
If you have... Could be. I mean, if you are doing mmap on a private...
mmap private.
Mmap private.
Mmap private, yes. In that case, it would make sense. But mmap private for a file.
Yeah.
Yes.
Can you do that? I think you can.
Yes, you can.
Mm-hmm.
You can have my private file, but I'm just thinking if once you create a copy, then it's not file system anymore. It becomes part of anonymous.
That's true. Yeah.
So I guess it is a transition that we need to handle carefully.
Yeah.
From file system to anonymous.
Yeah.
So that's what would happen on a write with MIP private. Right. But that's I guess that's a corner case that we don't have to worry right now. So Ricardo, how is your I guess your correctness or your implementation is dependent on Jesus, right? Because you're building on top of what he has.
Yeah, the only thing I have to discuss with Luis is how, you know, the file system part on the at this level interacts with his.
Yeah, because now the problem is that when he starts messing up with the pages at the virtual memory level, then those messes the pages of the page cache as well, because
right.
It's just this unified cache.
Yes.
So the point here is that actually the code that Ricardo is doing is where my implementation and his implementation meet.
Yes.
So
I guess you just have to ensure that the patches are created in exactly the same way.
In exactly the same way, exactly the same queue, and that's it.
And the locks are the same.
The locks are the same and so on, yeah.
Yeah, so that's what
you
need to ensure.
I don't think they are right now. Even the flag for non-blocking devices, that Jesus and Luis is not the same.
Yeah, I guess at some point we have, I mean, if we're going to, I think we should unify that. I mean, we were working with them separately, but I think it makes a lot of sense to unify that. So we should probably work on that. Probably once I find the bugging I'm having.
Yeah, Ricardo, I think it would be helpful if you work with Luis on this. At least, I think this is the part that Luis is doing right now is pretty critical, right? And without completing that, everything else is not that. Even the part that you are doing may not be as critical.
Yeah.
Right.
True.
Yeah.
So if you address that, then you know certainly we need to work on the integration and your part if we have the time.
So I'll let you get Luis's environment and I want to try the prefetching stuff. I don't know, I feel that's the thing, that's the problem.
I think you guys should work together, that's what I feel. Because, even if you want to try something, I think it's better to have Luis with you because he wrote the code, so he would be able to tell you what's going on.
Okay.
Much faster than you trying to figure it out on your own.
Okay.
Anyway, I leave it up to you, but I just feel based on my own experience that it's easier sometimes to work together and you'll end up moving faster. Because everyone sort of tends to get more, let's say, pigeonholed into one way of thinking, right? And it's better to have a broader perspective.
Okay.
And I still feel that the block trace analysis is important to give us some more insight as to what might be going on. Yeah.
Okay. Hey, Luis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the meanwhile, while we have the paper plug and all that stuff, could you run a larger version of Postmark?
A what?
Large Postmark.
LS or S. Yeah, I guess. What does the first letter stand for? Is it working set size or file size?
No, I think it's the letter stands for file size and number
of files.
Of files.
But the first one is the file size?
I don't know.
I guess it would be useful to see what happens with larger files.
But how is that useful?
Because that would
prefetching would play a much bigger role with larger files.
Oh, I see.
I think that's what Ricardo wants.
Yeah.
If how prefetching behaves differently with larger files. Okay, so hopefully we'll make quicker progress moving forward. I have a constraint. I'm going to be really pretty much very minimally available after December 15th.
Okay.
Because I have family visiting from India and we're going to Orlando and all of those other trips. So I want to try and finish this before December 15th if we can.
But OSDI, right?
What?
OSDI is the target, right?
No. Right now, the target is ATC.
Yeah, so
but that's just a target, right? I mean, not a real target, just
but,
for us.
But
so we should submit this to OSDI.
I know, but if we want to make it, I think we should take ATC seriously.
Okay.
I think we need to come up with a version of the paper that other people can review and send us feedback. The concern with this sort of work is that we always end up thinking after some time we start thinking alike and we miss out on some alternate ways of thinking. For instance, Ming's concern.
Yeah.
I don't think you were able to answer that question because we never discussed any of those.
No, actually, I didn't have numbers to support that. I guess.
Even it was difficult for you to understand the question. I feel, right? Because we haven't thought in those terms at all.
Yeah.
Right. So where is this question coming from? So I think we need to send our paper. We can get very different kinds of feedback.
I was thinking that. But we should send the paper out.
I think that's why we need to have a paper by USENIX, even if we don't submit it.
Yeah, exactly.
But by the way, the main question was if there is lots of locality, non-blocking drives won't make any difference, right?
Well, he's arguing that the reason operating systems don't do this, right, or at least in his worldview, right, everyone has a different perspective on this stuff. That operating systems don't need to do this because there is enough locality and the cost of a page fault is amortized across multiple accesses in the future, which is what we are taught in the OS class, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Okay.
That demand paging works because there is locality.
Right.
Right? And that's where he's coming from.
Right.
So we have to have a very strong response to that, supported with data. I think that's missing.
Yeah, but I think it makes sense in the sense that we're not the first persons doing non-blocking drives. People already do it for CPUs. So, and the same locality principle works there, right?
Yep.
So
yeah, but the thing is that
I guess we should probably
about very different kinds of locality. Right, and a very different kinds of overhead and costs, right?
Why the locality is different?
Because much smaller granularity. So.
I think the same, isn't
it? With CPU caches?
I think so.
No,
yeah.
CPU caches are much smaller. They are not a page size.
I mean, it's I'm not saying that it's exactly the same.
They are different.
What I'm saying is that it's the same at a deeper scale.
Yes, and you cannot generalize that quickly. Or easily, right? Cannot say just because an observation is held at this granularity, it's going to be held at a much larger granularity, right?
That's true.
It's being done at CPU caches, but it's not being done in the OS.
Mm-hmm.
And Ming's argument is there is a good reason why it's not done in the OS because, of what we are taught in the OS class, right? Or what we get to teach in the OS class. So.
Yeah. I think the key there is exactly that. It's how many times non-blocking writes happen in the same page. It makes sense. I mean, about the locality thing, it makes sense because you wait that IO, and then that means that you will access that page at all times.
Right, and there we have to be careful because locality for reads is not the same as locality for writes in the case of non-blocking writes, because locality actually helps non-blocking writes even more if it's for writes. Because if there is local writes to the same page, we can absorb all those writes without incurring a page fault at all. And if there are no reads at all, we could defer the demand page until forever and not even do it.
So the books separate locality in reads and writes?
No, they don't. They don't.
They talk about accesses and that's
it.
I wonder what the Denning paper says about it. I mean, if it separates read and writes.
No.
Doesn't. Okay.
I think it's interesting, right? I mean, it would be interesting to, for instance, since we have memory traces, is to do more fine-grained analysis for writes versus reads.
Mm-hmm.
So if there is a write fault to a page, are there more write faults to the same page, or is there a read? I think we did some analysis for write followed by a read, but we haven't done analysis for write followed by write to the same page, right? I think there is a lot of interesting analysis that we can do to support many of these kinds of arguments that we haven't done yet.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to have the paper ready. I mean, if it's not a question about whether we can submit to OSD or not. We can. We certainly will have the time to make a submission to OSDI. The question is whether we can make it good enough that it gets accepted. I think that's the challenge.
Yeah.
And for that, we need to get feedback. We need to get feedback from people, and we need to give them time. We cannot give them 2 weeks and say, okay, give us feedback.
For them, for us, because once they respond to feedback, we need time to address them.
Right. So we need lots of time to get feedback and make improvements. We had to think of it as a full review cycle. Instead of going through USENIX, we go through, you know, people we know and trust, right? So for that, we need to give enough time.
I guess we can involve my committee in the paper.
Yeah, and I think OSDI is not easy. Even if you have a great idea, they're still looking for comprehensive evaluation, answering all kinds of crazy questions. And you just need one guy who says, okay, well, these guys didn't answer this question, which I think is really, really important, right, to kill the paper.
Mm-hmm.
And he might have a, you know, good, valid argument or an argument that we don't agree with, but if there are people in the committee that agree with that argument, then that's enough to kill the paper, right? So that's why, you know, we have to work extra hard for OSDI and get this, at least the first version, that's complete, at least according to us, as much as possible, and get feedback on that.
It's a committee, I guess that's not right.
And the other thing is, I mean, you had to finish this work because you have other things to do as well, right? I mean, while those guys give you feedback, you can work on your other items. You need to.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's why it's not wise for us to delay this paper completion for a long time.
Yeah.
Okay. Right, so let's work to get this done in the next, 1 month.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Lewis, I guess you're working on figuring out what's wrong with the implementation as well as the figures, right? I think that's important. And and what would be good is, I see that you made some notes in the paper. It would be good to add reminders in the tech file.
I think I already did.
You did that?
Yeah.
Okay, great. And if you can identify something that I could work on, I would prefer to do that. Just, I have some time right now that I might not have later.
Okay. I would say that I mean, the part that can be done without the implementation is most of the text in the paper, like the design and I guess the implementation part. And in that you can do some writing.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
So I add the reminders. I think some of them can be filled in right now.
Okay, I'll take a look then. All right, good. So I guess I'll see you guys in the afternoon.
Okay.
Bye.
I won't be in the paper though because they have a doctor appointment.
Okay.
So, I won't be able to go to the paper club.
Okay.